Let's Talk Native is produced at the LTN Studios on the Cattaraugus territory of the Seneca Nation. We break all the rules for Native media by peeling back the layers of assimilation and indoctrination. We may step on a few toes through our examination of culture, art, politics, history, and identity. But the real goal here is to bring our people together by breaking down what separates us. So, welcome to Let's Talk Native with John Cain.
Sigal, I am John Cain, and this is Let's Talk Native. I want to thank you for joining us for the program. Look, we're going to talk about a weighty issue, and I know I always talk about weighty issues, but this one is one that, you know, hits home on so many different levels, and what I'm talking about is the suicide crisis that exists on Native territories, in particular youth suicide. So before I even get into any of that, let me make it clear that part of the conversation has to begin with the fact that there is a hotline, 988. It's kind of like the old 911, 988, which is the hotline. If you know somebody who is struggling and is considering suicide, or if you are considering suicide, or if you're not even there yet, if you just need somebody to talk to, I encourage you to dial 988 and talk to one of the professionals that is on the other end of that line that can probably help you through this stuff. So, all right, my guest today is Noel Bass, and for those of you who may have a really good memory, about 3 years ago I had Noel as a guest on the show, because at that time Noel was covering this issue and had produced a short video about the bears on Pine Ridge, and we'll get into exactly who and what the bears are. But it was a part of the Sweetgrass Project in Lakota Territory, and headed up, you know, by a woman, incredible woman by the name of Tiny DeCorey. And so I had Tiny and I had Noel on the show, and we talked about not just the short film that was done, but about the project. And since that time, Noel has not only accumulated more footage, and I'm sure he had plenty at even then, but he has gone more in depth on not just the fact that we do have this suicide epidemic, but even analyzing some of the causes. And as a result, he has produced a full-length documentary that is about to premiere at the 2024 Phoenix Film Festival. So let me introduce Noel Bass. Noel, thanks for joining me once again.
Yeah, hey, John. Thank you very much. I was listening to that intro, and it's so good. It's so compelling. I was like, I forgot that I was actually taking part in this. I was like, oh, I can't wait to hear this episode until you said my name again. I was like, oh, that's right. I'm on this. So I want to thank you for, you know, the work you do, and like how strong your voice is on important issues, and for talking about this issue again, because, you know, this is a really important one. It is hard for some people to digest, but I think what we're going to hopefully go through here, I think what we're going to do is, you know, make it really digestible and easy for people to understand. And then also I think people see kind of a place where they can, you know, make an impact, you know, play a part in helping out.
Well, and that's a critical part, because, you know, a lot of times we hear about these things, and no matter who you are, whether you're Native or non-Native, sometimes you may feel compelled to want to help, but you may not know what that is.
Sure.
So hopefully we can get there. Now, just because we have about a month until this Phoenix Film Festival, it starts
less than a week. So it's coming around the corner.
I got my month screwed up. Yeah, less than a week.
That's okay.
Yeah, we're already into April. What am I talking about?
I know. It flew by super quick. So
all right. So we've got less than a week to hopefully reach out and get some folks in the Phoenix area to head down to these. You're at the Harkins Theater in Scottsdale, and take a look at this documentary so you can begin to understand. Because if you're cold to this, and I realize that these film festivals, a lot of times people are looking for some of the Native entries into these film festivals. And they may not always know what they're getting. And so, and your name doesn't, the name of your film doesn't tell a whole lot. The Bears That's right. on Pine Ridge. I mean, they may think they're going to go see a documentary on bears for all they
on know. Animals. So, yeah, that's right.
So, look, I'm going to encourage people who are in the Phoenix area to make it down to this film festival, and I'm sure there's a lot to see there, but don't miss this one. And so talk to me a little bit about the film, and even though we talked about this years ago when you had done a short. Talk to me about the difference between the short film that you produced and had entered in as a short on a couple of film festivals at the time, and what you have now in terms of a full-length documentary.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot to unpack. But the first thing I'll say, in regards to the Phoenix Film Festival is, we do want people to come down because it's very much a topic that needs a community, because this is something that, when you're talking about mental health, especially youth mental health and, suicide ideations and self-harm, this is a topic that's very intimate and personal. And yet the crisis and the need for assistance is national. And how you have those conversations, whether it's within your family or your community, they need to expand out further, but there's a delicate way to do that. And the strongest way to do that is to come together in social situations like this. So we're not selling tickets. There's plenty other movies you can go and watch on the weekend. We know that. And especially in this festival, but this film, we're looking at these screenings more as an opportunity for people to come together. And so there's a Q&A after each screening. If this affects you, if you want to get more information, or if you just want to kind of start networking about this subject because it's something you believe in strongly, this is what we're excited about, is hopefully getting people to come together. So that's the first thing I'll say, and that. When we're talking about the film, back in 2021, when I first talked to you, it was a short film that, it was done with basically no funding, all volunteer based. And we followed the lead suicide prevention specialists in Pine Ridge. If people don't know, Pine Ridge is pretty well known for being maybe perhaps the most vocal about trying to help the youth with the suicide crisis and mental health in general. And I say the most vocal in not the fact that there's a lack of humility and they're trying to, expose this thing and glorify it. It's more of they put national attention onto it by declaring state of emergencies.
Right.
And these state of emergencies were a call to action. This is the way you can look at it, to the federal government. So when you do a state of emergency, the government has to take action. So when so it's like the same thing. If you declare a state of emergency for Katrina, when the hurricanes happened, or, any kind of state of emergency that may happen in your community, this is a call to action to the federal government that you need to step up your resources and help out.
Well, the question that comes to mind right away is, have they?
Yeah, so that's the issue here. And we touch a little bit on this in the documentary. And the short answer is no. And I'm sure a lot of people, and if you're listening from Pine Ridge or if you're listening from another reservation, that your state of emergencies have kind of gone unheard or just neglected.
Well, and look, I want to be clear here. We are not, the notion that we are simply part of the system of federalism, that somehow we fit in there with state or federal, state, local government, and that we are a part of this municipal structure, I reject that. So I'm not surprised that when we declare a state of an emergency, that we aren't going to get the same response that an American community, an American municipality is going to get. I'm not surprised. Now, I'm not saying it's right. I think I always go back to the same thing. when we talk about these kinds of these crises that are, that exist on Native territories, they don't happen by accident. I mean, they are policy driven. They are driven by U.S. policy. They are driven by state policy. They are driven by county policy. So a lot of the crises that exist on Native territories, I mean, they aren't a failure of Native people as somehow a people that are predisposed to these problems. No, these problems exist because poverty is a policy is policy driven. All of the things that exist on our Native territories are the result of bad policy by the federal government. So when we do a call to action or declare a state of emergency on something like this, it is an absolute failure. And I got to tell you, you know, there was a lot of noise made that once Deb Haaland, once a Native person got, you know, reached this pinnacle of power in the federal government, this cabinet position, and that she was going to be the head of the Interior. And look, and I'm not trying to call her down as an individual, but just because a Native person gets placed into those positions doesn't mean that change comes. Because at the end of the day, she works for Joe Biden, a white guy in the White House. She doesn't work for us. And so the national interest is, she's the Interior Department. I mean, that's everything from Bureau of Land Management to mining to all kinds of other stuff. Suicide on an impoverished territory that really makes the United States look bad. If you talk about national interest, there's a good reason why these declared states of emergency are not heard. I'll step off my soapbox just for a minute there. So because I get frustrated because I think the tendency is to believe that this is a human failure on our part, that somehow we are just not, you know, pulling ourselves up by the bootstraps. You know what I mean?
No, that's a big misunderstanding. I think that's really important that you're bringing that up. I'm actually glad you're doing that, because I have noticed that, you know, the Lakota community that I spent a lot of time in for this film is, and I'm not going to speak for the community, obviously, but what I noticed was they are very, they put a lot on their shoulders. So in other words, they have so many things that need to be fixed because, like you said, the, you know, policies, federal government, the history with the federal government, everything that's deserved and owed is not being paid in respect to treaties and you know, health agencies and things like that. And so it's left to the community to kind of pick up the pieces and do everything they can. And unfortunately, a lot of that, it's almost like these communities have given up on the federal government and they put all the pressure within. And if you're listening and you're from one of these communities, you know this, you know that you point fingers within because there's so much that can be done, but there's not enough resources. And we've forgotten that, you know, this is actually most of it is not your responsibility, but you've taken the call to action. And in fact, that's one of the things I loved about doing this film was this is exactly what we focus on. And so if I could just speak a little bit about that, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the failed government.
Please do.
Okay. Is that in this film, what we're following is actually the residents who are picking up the pieces that the government systems have failed on. So in short, there is a department, a mental health department on the reservation within the hospital. It's the IHS hospital, which I'll talk a little bit more about. But in short, they're not getting enough resources, and it's really shocking, and I'll tell you all about it. But so the community, residents who didn't, you know, they don't have a long history of degrees in mental health, or they didn't, you know, they're taking this on their own backs. And so in the film, we follow a group of residents who started their own organization because they were, you know, they're losing kids to suicide. In fact, it was considered an epidemic and they declared a state of emergency. They've actually declared 3 state of emergencies for suicide in a 10-year period. The last one was in 2020. And so these state of emergencies, again, are meant to kind of spur the government into paying attention, saying, hey, you're not delivering resources. We need your help. You have an obligation here. You're supposed to be outfitting our mental health department, our hospital, with the resources in order for our kids to be healthy. You're not, and we need to declare a state of emergency. So this film actually follows a resident-started organization that works within the community, with the community. They network, as a lot of Native organizations do, with person-to-person, knowing families, very community-based. And within this film, you're going to witness just how difficult that is to do. And you're also going to witness the contrast of, you know, like the hospital and its failures. And so this, I'm sure a lot of people who are on reservations already know this. They're afraid to go to the hospital because the hospital has failed them. They failed their mother, their father, their uncle, their grandfather, their great-grandfather. It's failed a lot of people, but a lot of the failures of the hospital in general, whether it's emergency or, you know, cancer care and all that, is overshadowing the mental health situation. And so that's what I hope people get exposed to.
Well, you can't talk about the fact that not only they're not delivering services, but they're still contributing to the trauma that causes the problem in the first place. I mean, even the hospitals. I mean, think about the cancer clusters that exist on Native territories because of things like open pit uranium mining that exists in some of these territories and some of these other circumstances that have been, you know, caused terrible health conditions, including the changing of lifestyles and diets and all that other stuff, the limited resources, the food deserts that exist in Native territories. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that contribute to overall health, but certainly to mental health problems. And the United States government is not just failing to provide services, but they continue to have some of the same policies that contribute to some of this mental health, mental health crises.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you nailed it. And I think, let me shrink it down just for a little bit real quick, because I think we can go down a complicated path when we take the butter and put it on the bread, and the butter is the government, right?
Right,
and then you
right.
just spread it, and you just think it's one big thing that spread.
Well, and that's my concern about just making it sound like this is just a lack of federal resources, because I think the problem is much bigger than that, because it's federal. It's a lack of federal response to a federal problem,
and I think that's
my point, I guess.
And you're totally right. I mean, like, the thing is, that's not a secret. The government obviously is. Here's the easy way to look at it. Or not the easy way to look at it, a simple statement. Okay. The government, we all know the government has obligations, and they divide those obligations. Okay. Within certain aspects, for like education is one, right? Healthcare is one. And so they create these agencies or departments. Okay. And it's the same thing with any agency they create. Like, there's one for prisons systems or whatever, okay, for like healthcare for veterans, healthcare for prisoners, okay. Well, they have a one for healthcare for Native Americans, because this was ruled not only in treaties, this was ruled in courts. Like, even most recently, it was upheld again. So this is a law. This has been ruled in court case after court case, that the healthcare, including mental health care, responsibilities of the government, they have to have adequate services for Native Americans. And there's an agency in place that's supposed to be self-managing and going to the administration and saying, hey, we're not doing a good job here, or our hospitals are failing, we need more money. And so that's where the resources part comes in. Because if you divide it, the responsibilities of the government as a whole, and you look at what we're trying to focus on here with mental health care, is that it is a resources thing among many other things, right? So if you go to the community in Pine Ridge, you'll have a whole list of things that they're working on within the community, which is, NEP, Sweat Lodge, language, education, you know, spiritual education, integrating more culture into schools, you know, giving more of an identity to youth who are kind of maybe split with, you know, are they, how do they fit in America as a Native American, you know, all these other issues, domestic issues, lack of, you know, economy, like all these things are on the list. And I see the community working so hard to tackle all of these things. Like, really, it's so admirable and just so beautiful. And they're doing it with little to no resources. They're doing it within the community, and they're doing it in their own way, you know.
And, well, and again, I got to bring it up. Yeah. And they're also doing it in the face of incredible obstacles.
Exactly. Yeah. But on that list, there's one that's missing that the community doesn't have to time to put on there. And that's the federal responsibilities of the health agency called the Indian Health Service. And that's because going against the, trying to, you know, get something from the government, they know in their history, like in the history of their community, it's just never worked for them. They don't get what they should be getting. So, so let me just, can I bring up some, I don't want the audience to be, you know, too upset or frustrated. I want, here's what I want from your audience. I want you to understand that, like, there's so much beauty and so much strength and wonderful things that are happening within Pine Ridge and other communities to help the youth. And what this documentary is going to show is that there's going to show a lot of, you know, this program that was developed by residents that took youth who were struggling with suicide and suicide ideations. You know, these are anywhere from kids that are 12 years old all the way up to, you know, 18, 20. And they, you know, have been through the worst of it, right? They've lost hope. They let everything get to them, you know, and they've unfortunately tried to take their lives. And this program, which is not started by any kind of federal government resources or anything, is self-made group where they brought in a lot of these kids and put them together sort of like in a family kind of way, gave them a space to talk to each other, and also gave them a purpose in the community. So they do a lot of like volunteer work, and they also do performances for kids. So they actually put them in costumes, like animal costumes, and they'll go and perform these fun, loving skits for children. So you'll see that in the documentary. What you're going to see is, I ultimately consider it a community-based film about, you know, what a community does in the face of adversity when they're getting, you know, no resources or no attention to a crisis. I mean, nowhere in the United States would you see this happen, where there would be this level of crisis when it comes to suicide with youth, and the government kind of turn their shoulder on, you know, turn their backs on it. So I don't want people to, you know, don't get too fired up and angry about the situation, because that leaves you in a space where you may not feel like there's any hope or that you can't do something. What we're going to try and do here, and what the hope is with the film and by talking after the film and together, is we want to make an impact, and we think there's a way to do it. And that starts with people understanding what can change if you come together and focus on it. And I believe strongly that the way to get resources into this mental health departments is easier than you think. It just requires some kind of collective and motivation to do so. And so I know that's kind of vague, but I, John, I talked to the director of the Behavioral Health Center at Pine Ridge, at that hospital. He worked there for 4 years, and I was trying to get an interview with him during the whole documentary. And after the short film came out, he retired, and he didn't want to talk while he was working there. And then he retired right when we finished the short film. And so it worked out to where now we were making this longer film about it. And I, you know, I got 3 interviews with him, and he, you know, he was a whistleblower essentially. He basically shocked us with the amount of negligence that's going on within the agency, okay, the health agency, and within that hospital. And this is where I think people can take this information, okay, and we can start gathering it, and we can use this to then go forward into government, you know, committee hearings and things like this, because you can now, you know, use this information to go forth in front of these senators and these congressmen and say, hey, listen, before it was all talk, it was kind of, what can we do? Are you going to help us? Can you give us more money? Well, now we have proof that there's major failures here, and you need to step up to the plate. So if you want, I can go through some of the shocking things he unclosed or disclosed.
Well, and look, I understand exactly what you're saying. I mean, I've always been of the nature to create a path to affect change, and not necessarily wait for somebody to open the door for me to walk through. So, yeah. I mean, that's kind of my nature, and I've accomplished some things even individually that that larger groups weren't able to accomplish. But a part of it is not being not accepting the way things are. And so one of the things that I have to say is, if Joe Biden is going to appoint a Native person, woman or otherwise, into a cabinet position on the Interior Department, then I don't think it's unreasonable to have an expectation that we should be able to get an audience with her. And if you can't, then the whole system has to be called down. And so I'm not... I'm not going to treat Deb Haaland with kid gloves on this thing. I mean, if she was going to take that position, and look, she posed in all those magazines with all that those Native clothing on, and she was on the cover of all these magazines, looking for all the world like, look, there's a star there, a Native person who reached this cabinet level. Well, I don't need her posing for magazine covers. I need her to address the mental health issue in Pine Ridge and every other Native territory. So while I hear what you're saying, I think we do need to make sure that there are whistleblowers. But you know what? Don't blow them in the wind. We've got to know who we've got to call upon. And so whether it's some Senate or congressional subcommittee or not, or if it's going directly at Deb Haaland. And look, call her out in the press, call her out in the media. Let her understand that we do resent the fact that we feel like we've all been tokenized if they place a Native person in a position and then nothing changes except for some magazine covers. So I understand exactly what you're saying. And I'm not trying to tell people to get up in arms, but I'm saying make some noise. And I'm hoping that when people see this film, they're going to feel like, oh yeah, if there is still such a failure, then what happened with this idea of a Native person being a cabinet secretary? You know, and I go back to the Obama administration when he created a couple of positions. I mean, he had a couple of people that were sitting in the senior policy advisor to Native Affairs, and yet things didn't change. So we've got to be prepared to really hit after some of these people who are being put up as window dressing, but not being put up for substance. And so I'm with you on that. I'm with you on that.
Yeah, I think it comes down to pressure. No, you know, and that's the thing. You have to apply pressure in order for things to change. And that doesn't mean it doesn't have to be aggressive or, you know, it's about continual, constant pressure and reminding. You know, that's why they have to announce a state of emergency constantly, because if you don't, these politicians are working on other issues.
And well, that's all and, yeah. And not to detract from this issue, but again, I think about the missing and murdered Indigenous women and people issue. I mean, again, I'm not trying to pick on Deb Haaland, but when she was a congresswoman, she initiated a law that got bipartisan support, and it was called the Not Invisible Act. This is in 2020. So in 4 years, they create a commission, And all there's been is studies. And the studies are doing exactly what you are suggesting is part of the problem. This idea that you've got these silos, you got education here, you've got health here, you've got law enforcement in another box. And so now all of a sudden they're saying, well, we're trying to figure out how to coordinate these silos, so to speak. So we're 4 years later, and now so Deb Haaland initiates the act as a congresswoman. She becomes the Interior Secretary. There is a report that is done by the commission that it was established in this act, and now the Department of Justice and the Interior Department are responding to that report. 4 years later, all we're getting is paper. And in the meantime, we've got people that are still going missing. You know, and I guess, and I don't know if your film addressed this at all, excuse me, but one of the issues also is the opiate crisis has turned into another epidemic. And I think in many cases, there's a fine line between the death wish I'd say that comes with some of that drug use and suicide itself. I think sometimes there's a fine line between the overdoses that are considered accidental and the intentional suicides that take place on our territories.
Yeah, it definitely plays into it. I mean, you know, drug use, alcohol, any of these domestic issues that happen in areas where there's high poverty and not a lot of enforcement to try and get to solve the opioid crisis. There's just it all comes down to the same thing. There's no resources, and then the call to action is slow moving.
Well, there's no resources because there's no will. Yeah.
Well,
I mean, not on our part. I mean, there's plenty of will on our part. Yeah. I mean, there's no will from the federal government. There's no will from the powers that be that can produce the resources.
Yeah, and then that will is another way of saying that is there's no accountability.
Right.
So basically you have, you know, and that's why these treaties are so important. There's no accountability on the treaties. There's no treaty agency going after making sure that these treaties are upheld. That would be nice, right? Wouldn't that be nice if you had an agency that was created specifically to police, you know, all the failures to these treaty obligations and, have repercussions and that kind of thing.
There's a UN permanent forum on indigenous issues, but you'd be hard pressed to have any of these issues reach that level of scrutiny. And if it does, does the UN really have the pressure? I mean, they pushed through the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which they say in the document is the minimum standard for survival and dignity, and yet you've still got countries like the United States and Canada that continue to operate in stark violation of this international agreement. So it is hard because where is that accountability when you produce something like the UN DRIP and there's no there's no enforcement power, then you get back to the same question. You've got no about accountability.
Yeah. And going back to the suicide topic, and this is one of the things, John, like there's so many issues that need a lot of attention. And unfortunately, the mental health crisis is one that kind of it's easy to not get swept under the rug, but it gets overlooked a lot because there are so many other issues that have already got this loud amount of attention. It's in the community discussion. It's been released outside of the communities. It's national knowledge, and there's been enough time to form strong evidence and activism and to fight these things. And unfortunately, when it comes to the mental health situation, it doesn't have those legs yet. And so that's kind of what needs to happen. And it will happen. It will happen. But going back to these committees and responsibility, accountability, the IHS agency is the Indian Health Service that's responsible for bringing adequate mental health resources. So when these state of emergencies started popping up, they started popping up in 2008, 2009, the first ones. And what happens is the government says, oh, okay, we have to, and I'm exaggerating, okay, we have to do something here, right? We have to get the Senate Committee of Indian Affairs, which is about 10 to 12 senators from states that have native populations. And they call a hearing, and they call the hearing something like seeking answers to fight the native youth suicide epidemic. Okay, so that, I think there was something kind of close to that in 2008. And you have these senators come in, and they're supposed to hardball, ask for hard answers from the IHS agency. So they sit in, you know, in their nice comfy chairs with their serious faces on, and, you know, because they're voted in by communities that have native populations, so they want to put on a good face, right? Like, hey, this is something I care about the community. So here we go. We're going to give it to the IHS. So they invite the IHS agency, and the IHS agency sends their director to speak about the issue. So what happens is they'll hold this hearing. They'll invite the IHS, and then they'll invite people from community members from Pine Ridge and other affected areas in Montana, Arizona, so and so. And what they'll have is kind of this, I call it like almost like a theater. It's like, we do care. We are making an impact. And they'll have this committee. It'll be recorded. And you have a very sincere, genuine outcry from these communities like Pine Ridge that come and say, listen, here's our problems. And they'll expose the problems. They'll say, we don't have a psychologist or a psychiatrist at our mental health department for 4 years now, and we've been asking for one. What's going on? Okay. And then they'll say something like, we have kids that are waiting 3 months just to try and get an appointment to talk to a counselor. We don't have counselors. What's going on? We have 80% of our struggling youth that are unable and will never see a counselor. In Pine Ridge, they don't have an inpatient facility for suicidal patients. So basically, if you're a youth and you're struggling, let's say you're having a tough night, and you decide to have the courage to go seek help. So you get yourself to the hospital. It's a very hard thing to do when you're at your worst.
Sure.
And you're fragile, you're embarrassed, you're ashamed, you don't have anyone to talk to. And you pull up your courage and you get yourself to the emergency room. And then if it's after 4:30 on a weekday, they'll say, sorry, there's no one here to see you. You got to wait in the emergency room. So these kids are already kind of sitting, now they're sitting in a cold chair, right? That TV in the corner that's like from 1980 that's still in every hospital,
yep,
is in the corner. And it's got like the Jerry Springer show or whatever. And, you know, these kids are just, they need someone to talk to, and they want a helping hand. And this is what should happen. If there was enough resources at this hospital and there was enough attention coming in from outside to outfit these hospitals, immediately they should be embraced with a warm blanket, some food, a hug, and talk to me right now. And we're going to get your family members in here too. Maybe tomorrow morning after you sleep, you're going to have a bed. We're going to maybe do something ceremonial, maybe an inipi. We'll have like, you know, something cultural based. But the main point is we want you here. We want you to walk in, and we want you to open up, and we love you, and we are a community, and we're going to work this out. And no matter if you have to come back every day, we're going to do that. Okay. So know that this is a place. Well, that doesn't happen, obviously. So what happens is they show up, it's after 4:30. They have no one there to see them. So they'll either set up a telehealth situation where they basically, after they wait a long time in the emergency room, and sometimes they're waiting in the emergency room and they have, you know, bandages on their arms, or, you know, they're injured. And,
injured, you mean they may have already done some,
exactly,
harm themselves.
Yeah. And they have to carry the shame of that. And, Well, anyway, so they don't have basically anyone there to see them. And the people that are in the emergency, their mode of thinking is, if there's blood, let's stitch it up. And then as far as mental health, we don't have anyone here for that. So we're either going to try and get someone on telehealth, which is someone coming through a computer screen from outside the community, about 200 miles away, like in Sioux Falls. And
which really kind of has to be the same thing if you call 988. And if you're one of these communities, I suspect you're probably not getting anybody that close that can, if you're on a remote native territory,
yeah.
And I'm not trying to dog this thing because I do want people to use the number, but I got to suspect that that's still the situation.
Yeah, I'll talk tell you an experience with 988 that I actually filmed. But keeping on this situation with the telehealth,
let me stop you just for a second because you kind of went a long way from the senators beating up on Indian Health Services because the end of the day, they're not providing them any money. They're not giving Indian Health Services larger tranches of money to provide these services. So yes, we it's great that a bunch of these, these bold elected officials can stand up there and beat their chest and say, there, didn't I do a good job beating up on these Indian Health Service guys? But if they don't, between the Senate and Congress, if they don't apportion money for this stuff, then they can beat these guys up all they want.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, what I was trying to show is more of the first person experience of a youth. And so what happens is, instead of getting that warm welcome and the resources that are there for them, in short, what happens is they get on a TV screen with someone and the person asks, 0 to 10, how close are you? If we send you home, are you going to try again? Now, these kids are going to say, this was a mistake. I shouldn't have come in here. And they're going to say, oh, I'll be fine. Okay. And so sometimes they go home and it doesn't turn out well. Right.
Right.
But if they say, if they're bold enough again to say, if I go home, I may try again, then what happens is, because a community like Pine Ridge is not outfitted with an inpatient service for mental health, they don't have beds, is another way to say it. They just don't have beds for these kids, or they don't have counselors there 24 hours. They don't have the resources for a crisis like this. So what they do is they literally ship them out to outside the community. And I like to kind of rephrase it almost like the hospital there is sort of like a distribution center, because what they're doing is, if a kid thinks that they will, or they've attempted to a degree where it's obvious, that the self-injuries are bad enough, they get a police car or an ambulance, or sometimes even a very expensive helicopter. This all comes from the resources for the tribe. And they fly them out outside of the community. It costs thousands of dollars. And they go and sit in a community that they're uncomfortable in. They don't know anyone. It's not cultural based. And they sit there basically on watch for about 3 or 5 days until they're just sick of it and they want to come home. But there's no actual coping mechanisms or skills or anything for them to go home with to actually say, okay, I feel like I've been given some tools here and I have now a connection to like some kind of community-based structure where I can actually talk to people. They're sent back to the same situation they were in.
With no treatment.
That's right. And basically what happens is everyone knows about this. So the federal government has already been briefed on this. All the senators know, the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs knows. The tribe has been preaching this to the IHS agency. There's not enough resources here. And the answer by IHS is that because they don't see putting more money into it, because from what they see from the basically the output of what's happening in the mental health department there isn't like, it's not super successful. So why would they put more money into it? It's kind of like backwards thinking. And so essentially they're distributing kids, they're treating them like resources this money is going out to other hospitals, and these outside hospitals, their mental health units are expanding. They're growing. In fact, you can, I can send you within the last couple of years, one of the hospitals in, I think it's like the Sioux Falls area, which is Iowa or South Dakota. It's just like basically close to Iowa. They developed this whole huge new wing specifically designated for inpatient mental health services. So where do you think they're getting a lot of that money from, right?
Sure.
So it goes a little bit deeper, you know, when you start looking at all these things. But ultimately, if the first person experience, if you're a youth, is, well, imagine I just went through that. I was brave enough to come forward. I didn't have anyone to talk to. I came in ashamed, scared. I get a TV screen, and then I get shipped out from my home. And now I'm feeling like I don't even belong to be here. I feel like I'm not welcome. I was
well, and it's not like there's not this history of trauma associated with kids being shipped away from their homes.
That's very true.
I mean, it's like, how can you not even recognize that the solution you're providing looks so much like a pattern of the trauma that has gotten us here in the first place? I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, well said, well said. Yeah, and in fact, we follow, in the film, we follow a young teenager who is very, you know, she has PTSD and she suffers from suicide ideations because her best friend took her own life in the eighth grade. And she just had never been able to come to terms with that. And she is taken in by this resident-based community that we cover in the film. And she is able to, like, you know, talk to others and help out and kind of, that's one of the most important things is, like I said before, when they're shipped away and there's nothing set up by these institutions, like the healthcare institutions, these kids feel hopeless, they feel alone. And so they isolate, they don't go back. Right. So these programs that were created by the residents, and one specifically called the Bear Program, which we follow in this film, they have created basically a space, and it's much more than a space. It's like a very active, activity-driven club of sorts of these kids that now have a place to go and bond, and they're doing out like work in the community. And so it's really hopeful. It's like really cool to see, and you get to see this particular teenager in the film do a complete 180, where she now sees the value in living, and she lets the trauma of her friend's death leave, and she sees, you know, just a more of a value by being part of this group. So the film does, you know, give people a glimpse at, you know, the power of what happens when you give youth a place to talk about this and a place, like a sense of belonging, and it's within the community. It's not shipping them out of the community. So there are some beautiful things that are going on. But ultimately, what we need are resources, right? Right. Even that program suffers to get enough resources, and they're floating on donations. Like they've set themselves up as like a nonprofit.
Well, there's plenty of money out there, even in the philanthropic world. But again, I still struggle sometimes with the effectiveness of the federal programs and sometimes the guidelines that they put in place. I mean, that can make some of these things counterproductive. You know, part of the issue is figuring out in any way that we can to get the resources to make some of these things possible. I, if you don't mind, I've got a bit of a terrible story I'd like to tell you.
And it
involves somebody that I didn't know, but I was a part of launching a bit of a series that was being broadcast on PBS. And one of the episodes was supposed to be about resiliency. Well, so first off, I actually went to New York City and I was a part of doing the launch on the series. Then when I watched the next episode, which I wasn't really, you know, I wasn't involved in these episodes, but when I watched the next episode, they were talking about resiliency, and they're talking about some of the things that were happening in this community. And they talked about this program of a certain kind of horse racing where the kids have to jump from one horse to another. And they were, and this was based on, I think, a Blackfeet territory. And they were talking about how these kids have been traumatized because there was, you know, a rash of suicides where some of the main players of their high school basketball team or junior high basketball team had committed suicide. So they go through and they follow this one kid doing this racing, and it all sounds real positive and everything else. And then when they finish the segment, they put the text up on the screen that the very kid they were following committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, did you kind of miss the point? And there was no place in the episode. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to call down the producers or even, you know, people may have seen it or may not have seen it. But there was never a call to action. There was never about, you know, write this person or contact this person or reach out to whomever to try to get the resources available. And, you know, and again, this was another very distinct community. It wasn't mm-hmm. Pine Ridge, wasn't Lakota Territory. And I watched this thing almost in horror because I felt like the way this episode dealt with this child, this teenager committing suicide, almost seemed a bit exploitive. And so my hope is that and I'm glad that you're showing some of the positive work being done at a local level. But but at the end of the day, what your film must do is loosen some belts, loosen some wallets, and get some of this funding that is so needed in the community, not at some center that they can, you know, throw a kid on a helicopter and send them off to, because you have to have these resources local. There, I mean, because, you know, I even looking at you know the short film that you did, you know, years ago. Part of the problem is the remoteness of some of these calls that come in. So even the people who try to respond within a community oftentimes have difficulty getting to help a child in time.
Yeah, absolutely. But again, if there are resources, then every community would have something available to them, you know.
Absolutely, but absolutely.
Speaking on what you just talked about with that other film, I think, you know, I want to kind of alleviate something that may be helpful in understanding that. And I don't know, because I don't know the filmmakers, but I do know that, like, when it comes to putting together the film, like, even, you know, the film that we worked on, it took years to not only just film, but putting it together. There's a whole process that takes a lot of time. And so you can develop the story and go through, like, especially since it was TBS, you're dealing with the hoops that they have for you to go through. And in other words, they have people that say, okay, this is good. They actually look at it. They treat it like a script. They'll tell you, you know, this is where the story should focus on. If they were already getting to the point where that film was pretty much ready to air, and then unfortunately this youth took their life, it's tragic for everyone involved. But unfortunate in the sense that they can't go back now. I mean, they could, but there's already been so many resources put into telling a story that the only thing they can do after something, it's sort of like cement. Once you've started it, the cement hardens and hardens. And if you would have to really put in a lot more resources to change that story. I don't know if that's what happened with them, but I could tell you a personal story real quick is on our film, you know, we did the short film. These two wonderful ladies, Tiny DeCorey is like the lead suicide prevention person on the reservation, and her partner, Eileen Janice, who is her niece, has been her sidekick, so to speak, for the past 20 years. And as we were putting together the finishing touches on the feature, Eileen unfortunately came down with very serious cancer, and it really knocked me out. It knocked everyone out. It was unexpected because she's such a strong person. And by that point, we had so much cement on the story with PBS, because this film ultimately got its editing funding for the feature film through the Corporation of Public Broadcasting through a grant. So basically, they're through VisionMaker Media, which is a Native American production company. And so there's timelines that you have to stick to by contract. And I was so devastated, and I wanted to honor her story. I wanted to just, you know, basically just show, hey, this story, it is positive, but look what happens. Life takes turns. And now, you know, Tiny is left without her sidekick. She's, you know, 50% of the effort that was in place to help these youth is now gone. And, you know, you try telling the people, that are helping you with the PBS or Corporation of Public Broadcasting, and there's just too much cement, and they say, you know, you just have to put in a nice memorial at the end. And so I'll say that may have happened with that film that you watched, and it is very unfortunate, but that's how long these, you know.
I understand that, but I mean, I guess part of the issue that I had was that comes at the end of an episode where they've already talked about suicide, and then you find the feature character in this episode, it almost seems like maybe that, I'm not saying the episode shouldn't have aired, but maybe it shouldn't have been airing in a segment about resiliency.
Yeah, it's disheartening. It's sad, but it is reality, right? Unfortunately.
I understand that. I just think that, you know, when we're trying to tell a story, that story ahead takes a terrible turn.
Let me just say one more thing on that. Okay, because I think it's important. Because what you're saying, it's important to kind of maybe see just a slight difference on perspective here. When it comes to resiliency, this is something that it's like a culture that's created. It's a mental belief. It's something that you can bond together on. Okay. It's important. It's essential for life. It's essential for going against the grain, fighting for what you deserve, all these important things. It's, you know, what gets us through the hardest times. But when it comes to suicide, these unfortunate moments, when they happen, it's the, like I was saying, the kid that has the courage in that moment. Okay. Because it's a moment thing. Just like when you see someone have a heart attack, underneath there's heart disease, right? Underneath there's some trauma, some health problem. Okay, so that health problem is related, you know, with the heart, but in the mind, it could be depression or suicidal ideation. So you could be living with this thing that needs healing. When it comes to the act of suicide, it is like a heart attack. It's a something that needs just to be saved at that moment. And so it has nothing to do with ultimate resiliency. Resiliency is super important. It's, you know, part of so many beautiful things. Unfortunately, with suicide, when the kids commit suicide, all they needed at that moment is someone to talk to. And what we see is, a lot of times these kids who have attempted suicide or have gotten themselves help at that moment, they're not trying to kill, you know, take their lives every day. They're living with a really dark depression, PTSD, all these deeper things that need help. And they have this moment where it's like being stuck in a very, 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 very deep well. And you can no longer see the light. And all you need in that moment, much like an ambulance showing up to save the person that has a heart attack, is just to see the light for a second. That's all it was. So what happened with this youth in the movie, he could be practicing resiliency. And you are going to probably see all the hope in that film, which is so beautiful and which should be the takeaway. But unfortunately, the help that he needed on one particular day just wasn't there. And that could have been for something like, maybe he was isolated. Maybe he had no one to talk to. Maybe there just wasn't something there for him. Okay. Or for whatever reason, you know, that moment he didn't have the help he needed. And so that's what we find is happening. And also another thing I'll bring up here is you could have all the foundational structure of resiliency, community strength, living a clean life, doing all these wonderful things to give yourself the best possible chance at living a long, healthy life. And, you know, but there's nothing there for you to to feel warm and welcome when you're at your moment of weakness. Okay. There's nothing there for you. And, that's why you see these fluctuation in numbers that are so different. So why is there communities like Pine Ridge where the suicide rate can be up to 10 times the national average when it's not part of the Native culture? Suicide is not part of the Native culture, and it is not the fault of the community, which I have witnessed firsthand, practicing the utmost example of humility, resiliency, strength, community work, all these beautiful things are in place, but they don't have the resources within all these other departments. And so it's very hard, very, very challenging if you can't get, if you can't have these institutions, like these departments, like the IHS agency, functioning as strong as it should, you're going to have these setbacks. You're going to have these numbers, and you're going to have, you know, a problem that shouldn't exist in this community, but it does, because the real problem, which is getting enough resources, is not there. And I'll just say one last thing, and I'll give you a stat to back that up.
Okay.
If you look at the average psychiatrist, and psychiatry, for those that don't know the difference between psychologist or psychiatrist, a psychiatrist will talk to the youth in this case and understand what they're going through and try and get them on, if it's a dire issue, like they're suicidal, and they'll say, maybe we should try a medication, okay? Which maybe it's not for everybody, right? Maybe you're against medication or whatnot. That's okay if you believe whatever you believe. But here's the stats. In America, in privileged neighborhoods, in less privileged neighborhoods, anything that's not, a native territory, like let's just say non-indigenous populations, the average psychiatrist who will prescribe some medication to help a youth with depression, they will see 20 patients a day. So every day they go to work and they're going to talk to 20 youth, maybe for the second time or whatever, but they'll talk to 20 patients, new patients, every day, Monday through Friday. So 100 in a week, and then you just do 4 weeks, 400 in a month, okay? In Pine Ridge, where there's a state of emergency that has been announced, three state of emergencies, okay? So 2009, 2015, 2020, the government is well aware of this, politicians are aware of this, the tribe's been speaking vocally about it. The behavior health department at that hospital, what do you think the number is? Now, they have 400 a month, and just your average psychiatrist in America, what do you think the average is in Pine Ridge? How many youth can they see a month?
Well, I got to imagine it would be an astronomical if they all had access.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I don't want to throw it as a quiz. This isn't but I want to show the audience that whatever your number you're coming up with, maybe you're saying, oh, it's got maybe half as much, 200, maybe it's twice as much. Maybe it's 800. The number is 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 a month. So, and let me lay that out for you real quick. So their behavioral health department doesn't have enough money to hire a psychiatrist. So they don't actually have a psychiatrist. They don't have a psychologist. Okay. So what they do is they have enough resources to call in a provider. So basically a psychiatrist from another community, another city comes in and says, okay, I'm on borrowed time here. You're paying me by the hour. Bring me the kids. Okay. They only have enough money provided by your government resources, the IHS agency, to pay this provider to come in for half a day. That's 4 hours a month. So one day of the month, this provider comes in and has 4 one-hour slots. And what's even worse than that is some of these kids have been waiting on this waiting list for over 3 months, maybe even longer. Sure. And so they may not show up, right, for whatever reason. Okay, let's not assume the worst. But so instead of putting someone else in that spot, this person that they're paying $250 an hour to come in sits there and twiddles their thumbs. Okay, so I just wanted to bring that up because people need to know that, you know, you put in your community, you put so much pressure on yourselves to take this issue on yourselves. And that's good. And you're doing the right thing. And this film is going to show you residents within the community that are doing exactly that. It's really beautiful what you're going to see. But you also have to know that there isn't a fair chance, an equal playing field. When you have 400 youth on average for every psychiatrist in the U.S., 400 youth are going to see a single psychiatrist a month. And in Pine Ridge, where the problem is 10 times the national average, and they've declared state of emergencies, and they're out there looking for resources, they can only treat 4 kids a month.
Right.
And so, I mean, that should get you angry, and obviously it does get me angry, and it should, you know, but what it shows you is that there's not enough, this mental health situation, the behavioral health department at these hospitals are being overlooked because there's so many other issues. And so we're hoping to kind of shed some light on the fact that, hey, this is, you can label this as mental health as so many other things on the list, right? It comes down to spiritual values, you know, family values and all these other
things. I go just the opposite. I think there's so many things that you could, that mental health must address. Not just suicide. I mean, like you said, depression, PTSD. I mean, these they may not necessarily all be suicide candidates, but the missing and murdered Indigenous women issue, a lot of that is mental health issues. The substance abuse issues, most of that, if not all of it, are mental health issues. So, yeah, and if you're only going to provide a part-time psychologist or psychiatrist to come in and maybe provide space for 4 people, you know, 4 people a month. I mean, it's insane. It's insane. So yeah. Look, why don't we, let me get back to the film and let's sure. let's close this out with a solid promotion for what's happening this next week with the film festival in Phoenix. Give me the pitch for the film as best you can.
Yeah, basically, you know, we want to see you. We want you to come down. There's going to be space for conversation. It's not just going to be a screening. You walk out and it's over and, you know, you're left with kind of your own thoughts on it. We really want it to be a place to talk. And so we do have a short Q&A after the film plays, but the festival is well aware that, you know, we want to speak longer on this. So they have spaces afterward where we can gather and hang out and talk. And that's what we're hoping for is come on down. You're going to see a film that ultimately will show you the, you know, I don't want to, you know, talk about resiliency and things like that because, you know, we've been talking about that with another film, but it does. It will show you a community that is really trying its hardest to handle an issue when they're getting no assistance for it. And you're going to see the power of community, and also you're going to see how this a program like this can help youth who is struggling to turn around. And in that, we'd love to talk to people, and we'd love to just find a way that, you know, maybe there's people that want to get something moving. And if this film is a resource for you, we're happy to use that as an educational resource. In fact, the film, just so you know, it's, you know, we did most of this through volunteer work. And then we got a little bit of money to edit it, to put this into a feature and to film a little bit more. But in saying that, like, it's not for sale. It's, you know, I'm not going to see it on Netflix or anything like that. It's going to be eventually put up on through the Corporation of Public Broadcasting for educational use for the next 15 years. So, educators, teachers, you know, professors, anyone who's an educator can use it, for whatever they want to use it for. And I'm hoping that that, like, alone will have, like, a, you know, just have a more of a lasting place to have a discussion around the topic.
Let me just say, look, I don't want to poo-poo the whole idea of resiliency. I just believe that if you're going to cover a tough topic like this, for one thing, we all know that with all of the best plans and even with all the best resources, there are going to be tragedies that still happen. And I know the most caring people in the world, part of, you know, the heartbreak is that even when they feel like they've made some progress with somebody, you know, like you said, in that 1 week moment, you could still lose that person. And so I understand that, but that's not where the story ends. I mean, even, and I hate to say it, to sound crass about, you know, what goes on beyond the next child who does happen to commit suicide. But we have to talk about that. We do have to talk about resiliency and how we get through this stuff. So I'm not poo-pooing the whole idea of encouraging and promoting resiliency. I just think that we can't end it on the note. You have to be careful on what note you end that story on. That's my issue.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, you don't want a film to come out and say, "Hey, it's okay now. There's no problem. Resiliency took care of this." You're totally right.
Well, and then have a text box go up about the, you know, somebody being featured, you know, that you didn't address the issue with. That's my point. And I'm not trying to beat up on this other program, but I know what you had done with the short film, and I know that I left the short film feeling encouraged about the work that was being done, even by people that I know were going to be exhausted emotionally and physically. So, I suspect that you'll see this film and you're going to walk away feeling encouraged, but also angry about the lack of resources. That's what I assume.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. You're going to feel connected to the issue, hopefully.
Sure.
In a way that if you feel a sense of positivity. This is a slow moving topic as far as making an impact. And this film is just one little resource to hopefully get a conversation going.
Yeah. So, I mean, these problems have been built up by in some cases, hundreds of years of U.S. policy that has led to some of these circumstances. I know there's no quick fix to it, but Noel Bass, I want to thank you for giving me your time and giving me an opportunity to address this issue on Let's Talk Native. I wish you the best in Phoenix. And hey, you know what? Stay in touch. And if you make it to some other film festivals along the way, or if you travel, you know, through other parts of the country with some of this, let me know, and we'll pick it up again, and we'll air another segment.
Yeah, thanks, John, so much. It's an honor, really. I feel so fortunate to be able to do this twice now with you. So
we'll do it again.
Okay.
Again, Noel Bass is the filmmaker. The film is The Bears on Pine Ridge. If you are in the Phoenix area, please do make it down to the Harkins Theaters in Scottsdale and check out the film. And you know, and look, be motivated. Again, I want to thank you, Noel Bass, for joining me for the program. This is it's a tough subject.
It is. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. I am John Kane, and this is Let's Talk Native.